One of the most difficult parts of sermon preparation is, for me, coming up with just that most interesting introduction that grabs your attention. I did not come from the famous preacher school, which says that you should always start your sermon with a joke or something funny. But nonetheless, every good homiletician will tell you to start your sermon with something that grabs your audience's attention so that you keep them. And some weeks, that particular illustration just falls into your lap, as it did this week. Earlier this week, in fact, on November the 7th of this week, the Founders Ministry posted an article on its website called, entitled, I should say, "Only Men May Be Pastors." You can find it on founders.org. It was published there November the 7th. And for some reason, I didn't write down the name of the individual that wrote it. It was a mistake, so I have to change that. The opening line of the article reads as follows, quote, "In spite of the fact that it seems more and more fashionable in our day to say that women may be pastors, the Bible is clear that pastoral leadership is restricted to men," unquote. And the article then goes on to defend this particular position, make an analysis of the topic from 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 12 to 14, the very passage that we are in the midst of working on. Now, I didn't discover the article on the founder's website. What makes this interesting to me is that that this particular article was brought to my attention from a completely different source. In fact, it made a number of news sites over the course of the week, and not because of the content of the article, but because of something else. The Founders Ministries took a screenshot of the title, the author of the article, and posted it on their Instagram page, as they do with all of their articles. And they posted it there in order that people would know that they have posted another article. Later that same day, only within a few hours of it being posted on Instagram, Instagram removed the post and labeled the post as hate speech. And informed founders that if they posted other articles like this in the future, their Instagram account would be removed. Now that's fascinating, isn't it? That's fascinating today. What that means to us today is that speaking of what is biblically orthodox is no longer to be tolerated in the marketplace of ideas, and particularly amongst the so-called social media of our day. Which means for you that this sermon and the one to follow it, Lord willing, is now to be classified as hate speech. To actually speak today of what is spoken of here in the Bible is no longer to be treated as something simply to be debated and understood, but rather is now treated by our society as hate speech. So this means that we have a decision to make. This means that we have a decision. Now, I realize that there are probably some of you who may still naively believe that this will all turn out okay in the end. But the fact of the matter is that these are continuing examples of what's really going on around us. We don't live in a post-Christian society, as many pundits put it. We live today in an overtly anti-Christian society, in which those of us who choose to stand upon the orthodox understanding of Scripture are now marginalized, ostracized, and persecuted because we actually have the temerity to stand upon the Word, which means that we have a decision to make. We can no longer be naive on these matters. We have to decide, and there's only two possible paths that we can take here. There's only two. And this isn't because we've decided there's two. There's only two decided by those who are making these decisions for us. The one decision is for us to either stand what the Bible actually teaches and face the hatred of the world, to actually stand upon Scripture and what it teaches and actually defend it Even though we may be ostracized and persecuted for it and be called haters by the world, that's our first choice. Or the other is to utterly capitulate to the moral revolution going on around us and repudiate our faith. Make no mistake about it. Those who would label such an article as hate speech are not interested in a compromise. They're not interested in finding some common ground with us that we might be tolerant. Nope. They demand the utter capitulation of the church to the new moral revolution. And what that will mean for us, that if we wish to capitulate to them in any way or find compromise, then that means we must deny the faith. We must deny what the Bible actually says. So there's the choice that stands before us. And my friends, if I might be so bold, I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I can assure you of this. This is not going to get better. This is going to get worse. And the days in which we will have the freedom to be able to actually articulate biblical truths is coming to an end. And so we have to decide what we want to do. Rod Dreher may be right when he writes in the Benedict Option that we may have to find ourselves developing our own ways of communicating with one another as Christians and withdrawing from the secular and social media complexes of our day. We may find ourselves becoming very much as the early church was, separated, isolated, and in many ways ostracized by the world around us. And I weep not for my generation, but I weep for the generation of those young ones in our congregation who are really going to have to face the brunt of this as the days go by. I mean, we're even getting to the point of the ludicrousness in our society. I heard another story this week about a PE teacher in a high school who is being punished because he refused to supervise a biological girl dressing and undressing with the boys in a locker room. He's being punished by the school board for that. This is the ludicrousness of the society in which we live. It's not getting better, my friends. It's getting worse. And as we rush headlong down this, we are going to have to decide, do we stand upon what the Bible teaches, or do we back away from it in the hope that we somehow can appease the culture around us and maybe they'll find a place for us? But my friends, that will never happen. For what they want is utter capitulation and nothing else. And so we come back again this morning to 1 Timothy chapter 2. You remember that 1 Timothy chapter 2 is Paul's first great imperative. What would Paul have this church at Ephesus to do in the face of the false teachings and heterodoxy that have invaded the church? What would Paul have them to do? And as we've noted a number of times now, Paul is concerned that the church be a praying church. And not only a praying people, but a people praying for the opportunity to preach the gospel, particularly the gospel of the mediatorial and ransoming work of Christ to every social class in every situation afforded them. We're going to be focused on prayer, not for our own comfort, but focused on prayer for the opportunity to express this great truth of Christ's work of atonement to everyone around us. But as Paul gets to verse 8, he turns his attention back to this issue of prayer, but he adds an element. And the element that he adds to it is an element of submissiveness. And I pointed out last week that there's a sense of intentionality here, deep intentionality. Paul is concerned that the church be prepared to go out into the world and to address with the gospel everybody in every class that they encounter. As difficult as that was in that day, as difficult as it is in our day, that's what we're to be prepared to do so. But in order to be confident as we go out into that world, we need to be sure that we have our own house in order, if you will. We need to be prepared to address whatever sort of class difficulties or gender differences, is where Paul's going to go, that we might have going on in the church inappropriately. In verse 8, then, as we looked at last week, Paul addresses the men of the church. And he says to them that they should be lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. That they, as men, we as men, should be pursuing a fellowship that connects us together as equals in the body. in the pursuit of holiness and godliness, no matter what our social or economic class might be, as we come together. It's inappropriate for men in the church to be using their world outside to address power struggles inside the church. The quarreling and anger that Paul is talking about is clearly that in which men gather together and quarrel with one another over who's greater and who deserves power in the church. In other words, Paul believes that the proper relationship between the men of the church is that we are to be mutually uplifting to one another, which is to say that we are to be submissive to one another, that we are to be working side by side submissively. Now, I want to insert a comment here that I didn't insert last week, but I was talking with someone after the sermon. I'll leave them anonymous so they're not embarrassed by this, but we were having an excellent conversation about a disconnect that appears so often in the life of men in the church. For many of us as men, and the disconnect that we have in between our life of secular employment and our life of spiritual pursuit. Now, there's very often a gap between these two things, in the sense that we have a life in the church and then we have a life outside the church, and then there's a disconnect between the two things, as though they are not in some way ultimately overlapping and mixed together. There's a separation, if you will, between those who say, yes, I'm a follower of Christ and I come to church and participate in the life of the church, but then go away from the church and pursue after secular employment and see really very little connection between the life of the church and their secular employment. And that seeps its way into the church. I mean, some of the greatest power struggles that I've ever seen in the life of the body, and particularly in Baptist churches, have been men who were in great positions of secular power who then come into the church and attempt to use that as the means by which they glean power inside the church. And there's a disconnect there. How many of us as men recognize that our secular employment is actually a vocation of calling as a follower of Christ, whereby we are pursuing the things of Christ in that secular employment? Meaning that our submissiveness is not just in the church, but in the totality of our lives as men working and pursuing whatever secular goals that we have. That's an important thing for us to consider. Paul would say, listen, guys, we're to be lifting holy hands, pursuing after the things of God inside the church and outside of the church. So Paul starts by speaking to the men as they are to be mutually submissive to one another, uplifting and supporting one another in this grand goal of reaching the world with the gospel. But now, verses 9 to 15, Paul turns his attention to the women of the church. He now speaks to the other gender in this multi-gender relationship. Well, there's only two. Not according to our world, but there's only two. And so as we move into these verses, I want to pause and define a word first before we move forward. And the word that I want to define is a word that you're probably familiar with or you've heard it before, but I want to make sure that you understand what it means, because I think it's the basis of where Paul goes here. And it's a word called complementarianism. Complementarianism. All right, let me give you my definition of complementarianism. This is my definition. I didn't pull this out of a book. I made it up myself. The belief, based upon a biblical worldview, that men and women are utterly equal in nature and status, yet possess complementary roles within the family and the church, in accordance with God's divinely established order for the sexes in creation itself. All right, let me repeat that so you get it. First, it's a belief based on a biblical worldview. So where does it start? It starts from an understanding of these things from the Bible. It comes from a biblical worldview. And it says that men and women are utterly equal in nature and status. Yet, they possess complementary roles within the family and the church. And all of this is in accordance with God's divinely established order for the sexes in creation itself. Okay, now let's talk about that definition in greater detail. First, when I say that they are equal in nature, what do I mean? When I say equal in nature, I mean that men and women both possess the fullness of humanity. The fullness of what it means to be human. The fullness, specifically, of the Imago Dei, the image of God. By virtue of Eve being formed from the essence of Adam, i.e. from his flesh, Genesis chapter 2, right? And God took a rib out of the man and formed it into the shape of a woman. By being formed from the essence of Adam, she gained from him all of his essential human attributes and divine substances. All of the communicable attributes of God that he indwelled within Adam, intellect, will, emotion, language, consciousness, etc., all of that was included in her by virtue of her having been formed from the man. So when God created Eve, he did not take some new dust from the ground and form it into the shape of a woman and bring this thing to Adam, but rather he formed her from him, communicating, if you will, all of his nature to her, and that nature which had been given to him by virtue of him breathing, God breathing into Adam and making him a living being. There is no difference of nature then between men and women at their most fundamental level. At their most fundamental level. Look, if I needed a kidney transplant, I could get a kidney from a man or from a woman, could I not? If I needed a blood transfusion, do I have to have male blood only? Or can I use just blood of a similar type from either one? Doesn't matter, does it? No. Our fundamental nature as human is identical in that sense. We're equal in nature. Men and women have a similar DNA, we have a similar blood, we have a similar organ, we have a similar ability to think, and so forth, because we are human, we are equal in nature. And I would argue that we also are equal in status. Status in the sense of being subject to the same issues of relationship to God, right? Subject to the same relationship to God. The fact is that both men and women can be equally reprobate before God. That's not limited to one sex. Probably the greatest evidence of that is Paul's own writings himself in Romans chapter 1, where he speaks about both men and women descending into dishonorable passions. He mentions both sexes involved in this depravity. He doesn't limit it to men or to women. Both men and women are equally reprobate before God. Status-wise, all humanity, male or female, stands before God in their natural state, reprobate, lost, dead in their sins, in open rebellion against God. That's not restricted to men. It's granted to all. And by then extension, both men and women can be equally redeemed by the saving power of Jesus. Saving faith is not unique to one sex or the other. God redeems, Jesus Christ, I should say, redeems equally men and women in every sense, fully taking them from their life of sin and drawing them to himself in perfect union with himself. I mean, this is what Paul says, as we know, in this great verse of Galatians 3. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. All those artificial distinctions are eliminated in the redemptive work of Christ. He has saved you, ladies, as much as he saved us, men. The work of Christ crosses that boundary. And I think that one of the best examples of that is the relationship of Jesus himself, the Jesus during his earthly ministry, in which he ministered to women in the gospel accounts. You think about the number of women that Jesus had encounters with and preached the gospel to. Probably the greatest example is the women at the well in John chapter 4. It strongly suggests to me that when Jesus came, his purpose was to include them fully in his salvific work. Even though in that particular day, women were second-class citizens in every sense of the word. In fact, to a Jewish male, the idea of female was less even in nature. But Jesus didn't treat him that way. He spoke to that woman and he gave her the opportunity to believe in him. He revealed himself to her. In fact, I think he revealed himself to her in ways that he didn't reveal himself sometimes to men. And gave her an opportunity to believe, which she did, and ran back to her village and told everybody that she had met the Messiah. They were the ones who were the first to see of his resurrection. This Jesus strongly suggests in the course of his public ministry that his relationship to them would be such that he would save women just as much as he would save men. Equal in nature, equal in physical substance, equal in status, but complementary in role. Now, this is where the radical egalitarians would tangent off at this point. You see, the radical egalitarian would argue that because women are equal to men in both nature and status, they must then by extension also be equal to them in function or role. The conclusion is that, well, look, if we're all human and possess the Imago Dei, and we're all equally saved by Christ and all equally reprobate before, then shouldn't that automatically imply then that anything that a man could do, a woman could do, and vice versa? That's where radical egalitarianism goes. It extends the idea to the next level, which is to the level of function or role. In other words, they would argue that when Paul speaks in Galatians 3:27 and following, and they would also argue the relationship of Jesus to women, they would argue and use these particular things, I would argue out of context, but they would use it to suggest this equality of role. They would argue an equality of doing as well as being. But that's not how Paul sees it. That's not how Paul sees it. For Paul and for the complementarian, God has assigned to each sex specific roles that are complementary to one another. And what we mean by complementary is that they enhance and complete what is lacking in the other, but do not become substitutes or replacements for the other in the completion of the human experience. Complementarianism says that man needs woman because he needs a helper, and woman needs man as his role in the relationship because that's the design that God created from the beginning, a completion or enhancement of what is lacking in the other. Now, this story, of course, goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 2. And Paul, by the way, if you'll notice down in verses 13 and 14, we won't get there this morning, but in these verses, he appeals to this creation order. You'll notice he's establishing it on this basis. In his mind, he's thinking of Genesis 2, 18 to 21. Adam, you remember, was created and he was alone. He had all of the image of God in him. He was yet without sin, right? He was living in a perfect garden that God had established. There was a world full of vegetation and a world full of animals, and Adam is living in this world. And God makes an interesting observation of the man. He says it is not good for the man to be alone. Now, what's fascinating about that is Adam wasn't alone. Adam had God. In fact, Adam was already in a perfect relationship with God. There was nothing to break that relationship. There was no sin. There was no limitation of it. But yet God makes this statement. Why? Because God understands that the nature of Adam was such that he was created in a way in which he was good, but he was not yet complete. There was a sense in which there was something missing from him. And this comes, by the way, if you haven't already figured it out, it comes from the fact that God himself understands this idea of peer-to-peer relationship. He understands this. He has eternally understood this idea because in the Trinity, you have three persons who have been in an infinite, eternal love relationship with one another forever and forever. The Father and the Son love each other in a divine love between them. They complete each other as the Spirit also in that relationship. God himself understands this as a part of his nature, but inculcating the Imago Dei into Adam had not yet completed this particular aspect of Adam's nature. And so God brings all of the animals of the animal kingdom before Adam. You know, we think we're so smart. You know, we live in the post-enlightenment age in which we have computers and smartphones. But I don't think we're as smart as Adam was. Because when God marched all of these animals before him, Adam gave every single one of them a name. I bet you couldn't do that, even with the limited number of species that still remain on this planet. He was able to distinguish the difference between a kangaroo and a platypus, between a butterfly and a sparrow. He understood the differences and he gave names to each of these creatures. Now, this is not just an exercise in naming, though. You remember that it was also an exercise in discovering whether or not any of these creatures would be a satisfactory partner for Adam to complete this relationship in him, to complete this peer-to-peer sense in which he would be able to relate to someone like himself. And guess what? None of the animals were found to be sufficient. None of the animals were even close. In fact, you will notice that Moses nowhere mentions in the text that God brought an ape to Adam and said, "This one's pretty close." No, none of that is in there. Because God ultimately understands that what's missing from Adam isn't just companionship, but completion. And so he decides at that point then to create or form, I should say, a creature just like him, yet different. Just like him, but different. Taking a rib from his side, placing him into a deep sleep, and taking this rib, God does the first grand surgery in history. And he forms a woman and brings the woman to the man. And as this woman comes, Adam recognizes this woman as flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone. She is my complement. She's not me. She's different than me. Yet she is made of me. She has the same substance. She has the same nature. And yet she is distinct and different. And it's this distinction and this difference that Paul appeals to as the basis of understanding the relationship between the sexes. What Adam needed was someone to complement him, to fulfill him, to enhance and complete what is needed in him. Yes, he needed to be complemented, spelled with an I. Yes, he needed someone to say, "Yes, you're doing a great job, Adam." That's a compliment. But that's not the compliment we're talking about. Adam needed someone to complement him in that, someone who would finish what is needed in him. Paul recognizes this complementarianism of role between men and women, and it becomes the basis of his entire discussion about women, starting in verse 9 and going to the end of the chapter. Now again, do remember something here. Paul is not suggesting that women are inferior by nature or status. He's not. He's not suggesting that women are somehow to be treated as less because, well, they're of the female or the weaker gender. There are a lot of women who are stronger physically than me, for example? Well, the fact is, he's not suggesting that women are inferior by nature or status, but he's also not accepting of the idea that women should possess the same roles as men in the church or in the family, because there's a distinction of that role. And the reason for that role difference is not because human beings have decided it's that way, but it's because that's the basic and most fundamental choice of God in constructing the human race. The radical egalitarianism of our day, which argues that men and women should be treated utterly and exactly the same in every way, actually destroys humanity. It doesn't build it up. It doesn't build it up. I'll give you one particular evidence of this, which you probably haven't connected. The fact is, the radical egalitarianism of our day, let's call it feminism, has now created a world in which men and women are so utterly interchangeable that there's no reason for us to procreate anymore. You ever notice that the birth rate in all Western societies that have embraced this massive egalitarianism, that this birth rate has fallen dramatically, even to the point where there are some societies in the West that probably cannot survive simply because they're no longer reproducing? I mean, after all, if women can be just like men in every way, then why should we have to produce children? Is it possible that the 60 million lives that have been snuffed out in abortion is simply a symptom of the larger problem of society saying, well, men and women are utterly the same, and so if men don't have to carry babies, then certainly we don't either? You see, here's what happens when you decide to ignore the roles that God has established in the very creation itself. You put society and humanity itself on the chopping block. And so Paul is not suggesting that women are inferior, and I'm not either, but rather that we have complementary roles that we each take one with another. I mean, the fact of the matter is that no matter how much the modern media wants you to believe that men can have babies, it just ain't going to happen. Now notice the text, verse 9. Likewise, also, that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. Now, notice that first word, likewise. Okay, you see that word, it seems to imply that Paul is about to make a conclusion for the other gender that he's already made for the one immediately before it. As he has said, just as he urged men to be submissive, to be self, working alongside of one another, he's going to make the same argument for women. Likewise, just the argument he made for men, he's about to make for women himself. The issue is the same between the sexes. They both need to understand how important submissive is in order to be effective in prayer for the advancement of the gospel. If men are going to be effective praying, Paul says, they're going to be effective. They got to put aside the quarreling. They got to put aside the haggling and the fighting. They got to put aside the statusing, which is what men do. Now what Paul is going to turn around and say, well, here's how women are to do that same thing. So he says to them, women should not adorn themselves. And then he gives a list of things like braided hair and gold and pearls or costly attire. Now let me ask a question here. Let's stop here. Is Paul suggesting here that women are to dress in ways that are frumpy or ultra-conservative because the issue of clothing is central to what it means to be a Christian? The fact of the matter is that there are some denominations in Western American Christianity that would argue, yeah, that's the case. Yep, it's all about the dress. It's all about skirt length. It's all about what we wear and what we don't wear. In fact, a few years back, I was attending a conference where the president of a fundamentalist college in Iowa was the primary speaker, and during the Q&A session, he was asked this question. President so-and-so, you see all these new students coming in out of high school. You know, they're coming to your college and they're coming for the purpose of education. What do you think is the biggest problem that those kids have coming to your college? And here's his answer. With a straight face, he said this. Oh, it's a dress code problem. Really? Seriously? So all these kids that are coming out of their so-called fundamentalist schools, or churches, I should say, and schools maybe, are walking into your college. They have a firm grasp on justification by faith, but they're wearing their skirts too high. That's the problem? Yeah, there's some who believe that, but that's not where Paul is going here, of course. Paul is not suggesting here that the issue is what one wears outwardly, okay? He's not talking about what one wears outwardly per se, but rather what one wears inwardly. Now, let me remind you where we're at here. Okay, in order to understand where Paul is going here, you have to remember the context. It's not likely that Paul has gotten to this point and decided to tangent off on an issue because the last time he was in the church at Ephesus, all the women were wearing pearls and he really doesn't like them. It's not where he's going. It's more likely that Paul is thinking of a continuous thought. According to chapter 1, what's the base issue of the whole letter itself? The issue is the heterodoxy that's going on in the church. It's the issue of people who are preaching what is false, but they're doing so as a part of gleaning power in the church, right? Isn't that exactly what we were talking about in the previous verse about men? Hey, guys, it's not about who gets to be the most important in the church and haggling and quarreling over who gets to be at the top. It's about us all being humble and submissive with one another and putting those power plays aside in order that we can lift holy hands before God. The issue is about jockeying for status or position from which one could control others, okay? That's the underlying thought or thread that you have to remember is key to what he's talking about here. So when Paul starts talking about women's dress, he's not talking about this in terms of just his problem with pearls, but rather for women, this appears in the church as an outward adorning of fine clothing and hairstyles and jewelry as women strive to gain status and power through more subtle forms of manipulation. Now that quieted you down, didn't it? See, the issue isn't about clothing itself, but what those outward adornments represent. What do they look like? What are the purpose of these things in the life of the church? Paul sees women's clothing and hairstyles as outward representations of how the ladies perceive themselves, both amongst other women and amongst and even over the men. That's where he's going here with this clothing issue. It's all a matter of how one presents oneself in order that one might stand and be perceived as someone important. That's where he's going here. You see, Paul makes a contrast here, doesn't he? In these verses, Paul makes a contrast. He contrasts between those who adorn themselves in this way, right? Adorning themselves with all the various accoutrements of status. Because that's what they are. They're accoutrements of status. Braided hair. I mean, today, none of these really mark as statuses. But they did in that day. Braided hair. Gold. Well, that does today. Pearls. That does today. Costly attire, right? Jewels of other kinds, right? Right? You put these things on, you wear them, and what do they represent? What do people perceive them as, right? It's the contrast between those who adorn themselves in this way versus those who adorn themselves with something far greater. And Paul says, those who adorn themselves with godliness. Those who cover themselves, verse 10, with good works. Again, let me point out an irony if you haven't already caught it. The so-called Me Too movement has highlighted a great irony amongst feminists, or dare I say, egalitarians, right? They claim that they're being exploited as women, and yet still insist on the right to flaunt their femaleness before the world in order to establish themselves in power. Have you caught that? Have you noticed that? Yes, I should not be exploited by men, but at the same time, I should be allowed to flaunt my femaleness in order to establish myself in positions of power. I mean no offense by the following. It's just an observation. What was the primary reason that Mrs. Clinton wanted you to vote for her? Because she's a woman. Flaunting femaleness in order to make a specific power, to gain a specific power? Notice the irony of this, and this is exactly where Paul is going here. Paul is talking about those who are concerned with status above all else. And in the church, as well as in the marketplace, they will dress themselves in such a way that they will flaunt their positions before others. Notice that word likewise. Paul is saying, just like men do this. Because, guys, we're not off the hook on this. We may not use dress to do it, although sometimes we do. But we will often use success as our adornment, in which we will come into the church and we will point to all the things that we have done in the secular realm, and we will say, I deserve to be in a great position in this church because, after all, I run a multi-million dollar business, and therefore I deserve to be treated as someone with great respect inside the church. We will adorn ourselves with that kind of power. Ladies, that's exactly what these more subtle ways do for you. That's where Paul's going. Nothing wrong with a pearl necklace, nothing wrong with some gold earrings. But very often in the world, women will use these more subtle ways to do the same thing. Here's what Paul is suggesting. Just like he's suggesting to men, hey guys, it's not about flaunting your position. It's about seeking to come into the church as equals, as brothers, engaged with one another in equality. Coming together and saying, listen, it doesn't matter what I am out there. What matters in here is that I'm a fellow brother in Christ, and we're working together for the common goal of lifting holy hands before God and pursuing after a world that needs to hear the gospel. That's what matters. And he's saying exactly the same thing to the ladies. He's saying, listen, it's contra women who are concerned with godliness above all else. How are they going to dress themselves? They're going to dress themselves in ways that are modest and self-controlled, his words, modest and self-controlled, to demonstrate their submissiveness. Just as the men who are concerned about godliness will look for ways to find true fellowship with other men, so women with similar goal will quietly pursue good works as a form of submission to one another. It isn't about us gaining power and position. Men do it, but so do women, Paul says. Their methods are a bit more subtle, but nonetheless, it's still there. Ladies, let me ask you a question. What does your outward look indicate about your inward nature? What does your outward look indicate about your inward nature? How do others perceive your inward godliness from your outward focus? The same question I asked the men last week. Hey, guys, what does your position and status outside this world look like inside the church? How do other men perceive you? The same is true with ladies. How does the world perceive you as they look upon your focus? Do they see your good works? Do they see your humility and submission? The fact of the matter is, this is the point that Paul is trying to make in the entirety of the chapter as he outlines what he needs from the church at Ephesus in order to deal with the very heterodoxy in the church. And the very issue is that you've got people who are exalting themselves in the life of the church or saying, I'm more important than everybody else. And in the result of doing that, they're teaching what is false. Paul says that can be eradicated. The false teaching can be eradicated if we cut out the root of it, and the root of it being people who are only after positions of power. So Paul sees the issue of clothing here as nothing more than a symptom of a kind of role reversal that he believes is inappropriate in the church. A role reversal in the church. And Paul says this is the symptom that must be addressed. It has to be taken care of, in that we have to, as both men and women, recognize what we really are before Christ. Yes, we're equal in status and nature, but God has created us to be complementary in role. And as we consider our roles, we need to ask ourselves whether our goal is to pursue the wrong one and to pursue the power that goes with it in the process. In other words, the issue of clothing is only used as a transition to the larger issue regarding women that he wishes to address in the Ephesian church, which begins in verse 11. But this is where my outline ends. Because it's not possible for me this morning, in the few minutes that I have remaining, to completely address verses 11, 12, 13, and 14. So guess what? You gotta wait for that for next week. But let us consider who we are. Let us consider what we do. Let us consider our humility with one another. Let us consider our roles with one another and what God has ordained as those roles. And then as we do, then we will be effective as a church in the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but not before.